From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, the civil war in Syria and its widening impact.
This has become not just a war within Syria, it's become a regional sectarian civil war. I mean, perhaps the best way to put it is to say that what was a war in Syria with regional spillover has now become a regional war with a Syrian focus.
We'll talk with Robert Malley, the director of the International Crisis Group's Middle East and North Africa program. He says the Syrian conflict is now transcending boundaries, leading to increased Sunni-Shia conflict through the region, and it's become the arena of choice for jihadis. We'll talk about what this means for Muslim countries, as well as for Israel, Russia, and the U.S. And our TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new season of the cult TV series Arrested Development. The new season isn't on TV, it's exclusively on Netflix, and David has binge-watched all 15 episodes. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The civil war in Syria has become a regional conflict that is attracting jihadis from all over, increasing religious and ethnic tensions in other Muslim countries, threatening whatever stability exists in the region, creating a new set of problems for Israel, and creating complex options for the U.S. The Assad regime has been strengthened by fighters from the Lebanese Shiite militant group Hezbollah. So far, over 80,000 people have been killed in the Syrian civil war. We asked Robert Malley to talk about the consequences of this widening war. Malley is the International Crisis Group's program director for the Middle East and North Africa. He directs teams of analysts in Syria, Iraq, Israel, Egypt, Lebanon, Tunisia, Libya, Morocco, and the Gulf. Robert Malley, welcome back to Fresh Air. A UN panel is reporting that both sides in the Syrian conflict are becoming increasingly brutal. Does that surprise you?
No, I think the curb of brutality has been, in a sense, since the very beginning. One side has massively more power than the other. That's the regime side. So they tend to be guilty of far more of the atrocities. But both sides have now been engaged in acts that are almost indescribable, from acts of cannibalism to the execution of entire families.
Both sides?
Both sides, yes. And I think human rights organizations and others have now documented that it's both sides. Again, you can't put them on the same plane because one side has far, far more power to exact those kinds of brutalities than the other. But at this point, I think it's hard to deny that the two sides are engaged in actions that are repelling ordinary Syrians who really don't know, many of them don't know which side to turn to anymore.
Let's look at what both sides in the Syrian civil war stand for now and what they want. President Assad, what does he want in addition to maintaining power?
I'm not sure there's much more he wants. I mean, this is a regime that whose preoccupation, if you're talking about the regime, there's some of its supporters that want other things. But the regime itself is intent on survival. Survival is victory, and victory is survival. And if they could live to fight another day, that's good enough for them. Now, again, there's some of their supporters who are rallying to the regime or are backing the regime, not out of any love or illusion about what the regime stands for, but because, as we were just discussing, they see what's happening on the other side. Perhaps they've believed some of the excessive propaganda of the regime, but they also see what the other side is doing. And among the other side, and it's too simplistic to say that there are two sides, there are many sides in this conflict, but what they see on the opposition are some Islamists, some people who are very sectarian. And so if you're a member of a minority community in Syria, you may not like the regime, you may fear the opposition even more. And so what they're fighting for, to the extent they're fighting, is to make sure that they don't fall under the rule of a regime that would be more sectarian, more Sunni Islamist, and therefore more detrimental to minority rights.
And who are the minority groups?
Well, there are several. The Alawites, which is the group that Bashar al-Assad and most of the top officials of the regime belong to.
And they're Alawite Muslims.
Alawite Muslims, although some Muslims consider them heretics, they are considered by some to be an offshoot of Shiism, although the Shiites don't really consider that to be the case. So it's complicated, but they are today allied more with the Shiite axis and against the Sunnis. You also have Druze, you have Christians. So it's a pluralistic, multi-confessional society, although the vast majority are Sunnis. The struggle didn't begin necessarily as a sectarian war, but it clearly and perhaps inevitably has morphed into one, and for the most part opposes the minority Alawite community, roughly 10 to 12%, although there hasn't been a census recently, and on the other side, the majority Sunnis. But there are many in between, some minority groups that feel closer to the regime and others who have allied with the Sunnis. It's not black and white. Not all minorities are on one side or the other.
My impression is that the conflict in Syria started, with people opposing the Assad regime. Is it fair to call it a dictatorship?
I think that's fair. Yes.
Okay, and then it kind of broadened into something more resembling an Islamist rebellion, because you have now Islamists coming from all over the region. The rebels have support from groups including Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So what is the evidence that the rebels in Syria are becoming more Islamist?
Well, I mean, this is a multi-layered conflict. There is, at one level, an uprising by ordinary citizens against a regime that has been authoritarian, corrupt, disrespectful of basic human rights. But added to that have been several other layers of conflict. There is a sectarian conflict between Sunnis and Alawites, and then it's a conflict both of Islamists against the regime, but also of Islamists within the opposition against non-Islamists or different shades of Islamists within the opposition. Superimposed upon that, there's a regional war between Sunnis and Shiites, between Persians and Arabs, and perhaps even superimposed upon that is now a Cold War between, or a newly minted Cold War between the U.S. and Russia. So the Islamist factor is a real one, and I think, again, all reports indicate that Islamists have gained greater power within the opposition, but partly because they are the best, they are the most willing to fight and to sacrifice, but also because in periods of despair, we've seen this historically, people tend to turn to religion and to different forms of religion, and in this case, the Islamists offer some solace, some refuge for people who are living under absolutely intolerable, unacceptable, unspeakable conditions. The Islamists also, some of the most extreme Islamists have had the ability to raise funds in Gulf Arab countries. Some of them have also been the best organized on the ground in terms of caring for people. Some of these groups may sound paradoxical, but some of the most sectarian groups, the most Islamist groups, are the ones who have been able to take care of those who they more or less govern in the areas that are more or less liberated, and do it in a less corrupt, less violent, less chaotic way than the less Islamist groups. So it is clear that over time, the most extremist radical wing of the Islamists, those who go under the label of the Nusra Front, which is an offshoot and an ally of Al-Qaeda, they have gained in potency because they are better armed, they're better resourced, they're better fighters, they're more mobilized. And so they attract more people to them. They don't dominate the opposition. It's a very pluralistic, disorganized, chaotic opposition. But over time, they have put their imprint on the opposition more than others.
An Egyptian sheikh living in Qatar issued a fatwa calling on Muslims around the world to support the Syrian rebels. He said this last week. And he called Hezbollah and Iran, quote, more infidel than Jews and Christians. How do you interpret that?
Well, it is what I was saying earlier. This has become not just a war within Syria, it's become a regional sectarian civil war. I mean, perhaps the best way to put it is to say that what was a war in Syria with regional spillover, has now become a regional war with a Syrian focus. And that sort of captures where we are today. Syria is the battleground. It's not the sole actor in this conflict. You now have many others who are engaged. And in particular, this conflict between Sunnis and Shiites, this long-lasting conflict, but which has not manifested itself violently that much in recent history, is now manifesting itself with a vengeance. In Syria, and what Sheikh Qardawi, the cleric you referred to, said was extraordinarily sectarian in tone, but matched by some of the sectarian pronouncements that other clerics on the other side have been saying. But what he said, and he's a very influential cleric, was quite frightening.
But I'm also hearing to call groups of Muslims more infidel than Jews. That's a pretty strong statement coming from a sheikh in Qatar, isn't it?
Sure it is. And I think, when Hezbollah now, the Shiite movement in Lebanon, is fighting Sunnis in Syria, in its own way it's saying that the fight against certain Sunni groups in Syria has taken primacy over the fight against Israel, whom they're not fighting. So they're waging the fight they can fight in the arena that they think they can prevail. And to that extent, they're putting the Israeli question in brackets, by saying that they're more infidel than the Jews. Obviously, he's saying that Jews are infidels as well. But he's saying that the priority fight today is against the unbeliever Shiite. And that's the fight, that's the focus in Syria right now, which doesn't mean that they're prepared to ally themselves with Israel. I mean, let's not be under any illusion regarding that, but that the priority for them today and the priority on both sides is to fight one another, not to fight Israel.
My guest is Robert Malley, director of the International Crisis Group's Middle East and North Africa program. We'll talk more about the widening war in Syria after a break. This is Fresh Air. you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Malley. He's the director of the International Crisis Group's Middle East and North Africa program. So you were saying that the war in Syria is now really like a regional war. Let's look at Lebanon, which has become involved in this war. Hezbollah has entered the fight in support of Syria's President Assad. Why has the leader of Hezbollah chosen to support Assad?
Well, first, I think we really need to change our sort of our mental grid, our political compass. This is not a war that's being fought by nation states. Borders are being erased. Borders are becoming liquid in a way. And as you said, Hezbollah is fighting in Syria. We could also say that some Sunnis in Lebanon are fighting in Syria as well. Some Syrian Sunni rebels are firing back into Lebanon against Hezbollah targets. Iraqi Shiites are fighting on behalf of the regime, just as Iraqi Sunnis are trying to help their co-religionists in Syria. So I think you have to think of Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq as one giant integrated area of conflict in which national boundaries count much less than sectarian confessional boundaries. And in the case of Hezbollah, and I think Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, sees in the fight in Syria a sort of a preemptive war against his own movement, and believes that if they lose in Syria, not only does he lose an ally, not only does he lose a conduit, a channel that through which he's received weapons, Iran delivers weapons to Hezbollah through Syria, but he will have lost the first round in what he believes is a long-lasting fight. Now, in his mind, the fight is against Sunni Islamists, it's against Israel, it's against the United States. But putting that aside, what matters for him, it's almost like President Bush's version or Nasrallah's version of President Bush's preemptive war. We have to wage war in Syria to defeat our enemies there, because if we don't, if we lose Syria, we will be much more vulnerable to the next round of attacks, which could be waged by the U.S., could be waged by Israel, could be waged by Sunni Islamists. It doesn't matter, but we have to fight where we can at a time when we have more power, because otherwise we're going to be much more vulnerable.
What has Hezbollah sent in terms of men or weapons to Syria in support of Assad, and what kind of retaliation have the rebels waged across the border into Lebanon?
It's hard to, you know, the numbers are in the thousands, again, according to Western officials, and now according even to some people close to Hezbollah, who are saying that they have several thousand in one particular village on the border of Syria and Lebanon, which is a crucial strategic crossing point for weapons in both directions. And now claims that Hezbollah fighters are massing in the northernmost populated city of Aleppo, which is a crucial target, a crucial city for the opposition, which has been trying to occupy and which has made real progress. But there's now reports, again, these are some media reports and some others, that Hezbollah fighters are trying to come to the help of the regime to try to dislodge the opposition from Aleppo. We don't know the numbers. Let's say several thousand, and they are much more professional than the regular Syrian troops, and certainly more professional than the militias that have been organized by the Syrian regime. And there even are reports of Hezbollah fighters being, to say the least, disappointed, disillusioned, and sometimes quite shocked by how unprofessional, amateurish that their Syrian counterparts are. So they're better fighters. They're more professional. They have a greater sense of hierarchy. And so where they fight, the regime seems to do better. But of course, now there is retaliation by some of the Sunni opposition groups, which are targeting Hezbollah strongholds in Lebanon, firing from Syria. Again, showing that borders become increasingly meaningless, because on both sides, the war is being waged against the other. Now, Hassan Nasrallah had a statement recently in which he said, "We in Lebanon may disagree about which side we back in Syria, but let's fight that war in Syria, not in Lebanon." To which the Sunni rebels responded, "If you think you could fight in Lebanon, in Syria, and we're not going to respond and retaliate in Lebanon, think again." So this really, of course, does have the risk of reigniting the civil war, this 15-year civil war in Lebanon that only ended in 1990. It could well reignite it. No matter where the conflict goes in Syria, the risk is very, very grave that Lebanon will relive one of its darkest chapters.
That would be so tragic. That war went on for so long.
Well, and it's not only there. You know, Iraq as well is just barely recovering from its sectarian civil war, and you're seeing increasingly mobilization of Shiite and Sunni communities in Iraq, not only because of what's happening in Syria. There are problems in Iraq that were festering before the Syrian conflict began, but Syria is certainly heightening the stakes for Prime Minister Maliki, the Shiite Prime Minister of Iraq. The notion that the Sunnis would gain power in Syria is viewed as a very, very dangerous threat. And for the Sunnis in Iraq, the notion that their co-religionists in Syria may prevail emboldens them and gives them a sense perhaps this is a time where they can exact revenge as well.
You were describing how the Syrian civil war has expanded into other countries, and that it's really not about nation states. It's about the groups within those states, and you know, Shia siding with Shia and Sunni siding with Sunni across national boundaries. What does this mean for Israel? In some ways, you could say Israel's enemies are at war with each other. Right. Where does that leave Israel?
I mean, I think Israel has been in a very ambivalent position from the outset for many reasons. I mean, in some ways, as you say, to see your foes bleeding each other is not necessarily the worst outcome. On the other hand, it's caught between, on the one side, the Assad regime, which has been supporting Hezbollah, which is close to Iran, and therefore is an enemy of Israel. I mean, objectively, even though the border between Israel and Syria has been the calmest of any of Israel's borders, it nonetheless is a fact that the Syrian regime has been helping Hezbollah, and Hezbollah has been at war with Israel. The Syrian regime is allied with Iran, which is viewed by Israel as a threat. So there's no love lost between the regime in Damascus and Israel. On the other hand, the opposition, some of its elements may be more or less acceptable, but there is this strong Islamist trend. There's this strong Al-Qaeda wing. That's not good news for Israel. I mean, if they were to prevail, or if they were at least to prevail in parts of Syria, if they were to prevail, if they were to have a position of influence on the border areas with Israel, that would be bad news as well. So there's another factor as well, which I think we really have to bear in mind as we try to, as I say, come to terms with a new region. I mean, this is a region which is not what it was 3 years ago before the Arab uprisings. It's certainly not what it was like 10 years ago. Israel has looked at its neighbors, and Syria in particular, with two principles in mind. One is the notion of red lines. There's certain actions, if you take them, we will strike. We, Israel, will strike. So if chemical weapons or sophisticated weapons are transferred by the Syrian regime to Hezbollah, Israel will strike as it has struck in the past. That's one principle of its policy. The other one is the notion of an address. They think that they can deter the Syrian regime because it's a regime that has interests, it has stakes in its own, a stake in its own survival. So they're the address. They're the ones you're going to threaten if they do cross the red line. What's happening now with this erasing of borders and with this very, very strong alliance between Iran, Hezbollah, and the Syrian regime is that both those principles are being called into question. What does it mean to say the red line is a transfer of weapons when Hezbollah, Syria, and Iran's military machines are integrated? Who's transferring what to whom? It doesn't make sense anymore. Hezbollah's weapons are Syria's weapons or Iran's weapons when it comes to Syria. So that's the first issue that becomes difficult for Israel to grapple with. The second is the notion of an address. The more the Syrian regime disintegrates, becomes a collection of militias, a fighting force more than a state, the harder it is to deter. I mean, what are the targets? Who is the address to whom you're addressing your threats? So it may well be at some point that Israel finds itself dragged into this war because it can no longer conduct its strategy the way it used to, which is by dictating red lines and threatening central addresses. The address is now becoming much more decentralized, and the red lines are becoming much harder to enforce because, as I said, it's much harder to know who has the weapons and where they're being transferred.
It seems that Israel really has no side to support in the Syrian civil war.
Now that's a very good question. I think it applies in some ways to more than Israel. It applies to the West as a whole. It's hard. No, they're not. There's not one side that is pristine. Now there may be a side that is morally superior, that is more appealing, but there's no doubt that there's now both ugliness on both sides and dangers on both sides. Again, it's not a matter of a moral equation. One could be far worse than the other, But nonetheless, if you're sitting in Jerusalem, if you're trying to make a decision and you're trying to weigh the alternatives, the survival of the Assad regime weakened on the one hand, yes, but still it would be a victory for Iran and Hezbollah, or the victory of the opposition, which would be a blow for Iran but could empower Islamists at a time when Islamists are gaining ground in Egypt, when they're gaining ground in Tunisia, when they're gaining ground in Libya. If they gain ground in Syria, could Jordan be that far behind? And then Israel is facing something that it may consider far more dangerous than what it's facing today. So yes, I think it's a very difficult decision for Israel, and I think Israel has so far tried to stay out of the conflict as much as possible, has sent messages through intermediaries to the Syrian regime saying, we're not after you, we're after certain actions that you're taking, for example, the transfer of weapons to Hezbollah, but we don't have a stake in the struggle, whether you survive or lose. Those are, according to the Russians, messages that are being conveyed. But no, this is, in a way, Israel is caught between a rock and a hard place.
Robert Malley will be back in the second half of the show. He's the director of the International Crisis Group's Middle East and North Africa program. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from members of the American Institute of Architects, working to build better homes, businesses, and communities, building for life. More at aia.org. From Chevrolet, maker of the Volt, an electric car also powered by gas to help drivers go the distance and then some. Details at chevyvolt.com. And from Arizona State University Online, more than 60 undergraduate and graduate online degree programs at radio.asu.edu. This is NPR.
Coming up, why figuring out how the U.S. should respond to the civil war in Syria is more complicated than it may seem. We continue our conversation with Robert Malley of the International Crisis Group. And after having binge-watched all 15 new episodes of Arrested Development on Netflix, our TV critic David Bianculli has a review. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about how the civil war in Syria has widened into a regional war and what the consequences are in the region and for the U.S. My guest is Robert Malley, the director of the International Crisis Group's Middle East and North Africa program. You were discussing how Israel really doesn't have a side that it can support because both sides pose potential threats to Israel. Let's extend that to the West in general and the United States in particular. What are the potential problems that the United States faces in deciding what, if any, further action to take in Syria?
I mean, first, I think, yes, the United States, the administration has a side. There's no doubt about it. It has a side. It has affinities with the opposition. It doesn't want to see the regime continue. President Obama said in August 2011, a few months after, into the uprising, when he said, President Assad has to go. So I think there's no ambiguity about which side the U.S. is on. There's more ambiguity in the case of Israel. In the case of the U.S., I don't think there's any ambiguity. The question in my mind, one of the things that we have to be careful about, that we have to bear in mind, is we may have a stake in whether the Assad regime continues or not. But do we have a stake, or should we have a stake, in the broader Sunni-Shiite confrontation? Should we take sides in this religious war, which is it has now become? Should we take sides in this war not against Iran's policies, but against Iran per se? I mean, there is antipathy towards Iranians, or Persians, that Arabs want to contain and suppress any Iranian influence in the region. Again, we have legitimate problems with the shape of Iranian rule, the character of its regime, with a nuclear program. But do we have a problem with Iran per se, as some of the Sunni Arab states do? So this is one of the major problems, I think, in devising a policy, is disentangling between our fights, our legitimate fights, and the fights that others want us to be dragged into. Others want us to be dragged into the sectarian struggle between Sunnis and Shiites, in which I would argue we don't have a stake.
Who are the others you're talking about?
Whether it's Sunni Gulf Arab states, I mean, many who are supporting the opposition in Syria have an agenda, which is their agenda, which is to end, to suppress and Shiites in the region, to suppress Iran's influence in the region. That's the agenda. And you mentioned the Egyptian cleric who lives in Qatar. He was expressing a view that others have, which is this is a fight to the death against Shiites. That is not America's fight. In the case of Iraq, we helped the Shiites come to power. As you know, they were the majority. So we don't have anything against Shiism per se. We don't have anything against Iran per se. We have something against specific policy. Then that's how can we be smart enough to be part of a struggle, but be part of our struggle, defending our interests and not letting us be dragged into a fight in which we don't have a stake. People are trying to drag us into into their wars. And that's really one of the main issues we have to bear in mind.
Well, some people here want us to get involved in the war. Senator McCain has been urging military intervention.
Right. And that's I mean, I think Senator McCain would say he's doing this because he wants to help the people of Syria have a more democratic, pluralistic future. I mean, he also wants to weaken Iran, but he has, you know, his view, and I think it comes from a very valid concern, which is the extraordinary death toll. And we didn't speak about the refugee crisis and, you know, 1.5 million refugees, more or less, 4 million, if not more, displaced persons out of a population of a little over 20 million. I mean, we're really talking one of the most catastrophic humanitarian disasters we're facing. So it's understandable that some people want to act. What I'm saying is we have to be careful about understanding that this is not in its entirety, it's not our war. There may be pieces of it that are our struggle, but this is not a war in which we have a real stake. There's enough reason to be cautious, to think hard, to think also, what are the interests that we are pursuing? And there's a whole list that we could be pursuing. Ending the violence and the killing. Very noble effort to try to end the slaughter. Or is the goal to end Iranian influence in Syria? Is it to avert regional instability? Is it to promote democracy? Is it to minimize or end to make sure that chemical weapons are neither used nor transferred? Is it to make sure that jihadists don't have a hold in Syria? Is it to limit Russian influence? All of these interests arguably are defensible. All of them can be justified, but you can't pursue each and every one of them simultaneously because they are in conflict with one another. If, for example, your goal were strictly to end the violence and the killing, then maybe you'd be prepared to agree to some form of compromise that would entail a degree of continuation of elements of the current regime and some degree of continuation of Iranian influence in Syria. If your only goal was, let's end the violence. If your goal is to end Iranian influence and to deal Iran a real blow in Syria, then certainly you can't accept that. Your goal then is to defeat Iran in Syria. So we need to decide before we jump to whatever action we're going to take, what are our priorities? What resources are we prepared to expend in order to achieve them? And what is the likelihood that by expending these resources, we're going to get the result we want? Again, that doesn't prejudge the outcome of this thinking process, but it means that we can't want everything at all times and think that we can achieve them because these are competing interests, and some of them should take priority over others.
So you've just spelled out some of the problems we'd face with military intervention. Secretary of State John Kerry wants to organize an international peace conference to resolve the civil war in Syria, but he says we're late. It's a little late to be starting this. Again, getting back to what you were saying about this is really a widening into a conflict of militias and sectarian fighting that crosses national boundaries. So what are the odds that your traditional peace conference with heads of state or their appointees would reach any lasting agreement?
Nobody's ever lost any money betting on failure in the Middle East in general, so obviously there's room for skepticism. I think what Secretary Kerry's intuition was, and I think it's the right one. Again, this is not doesn't mean that Geneva's going to succeed. There's every reason to believe that that it's going to fail. But given how complex the situation is on the ground, given how regional the conflict has become, given how global it has become, what you fear you need to have is an agreement between Russians and Americans on what the outcome needs to look like, and then you try to expand the circle of getting others to buy into it. We're not there yet.
Why start it that way? Why start it, not getting Assad to the table, but getting Russia to the table?
Because if Assad has Russia completely on its side, completely on his side, he won't budge. There's no reason for him to budge. You could say the same about the opposition, but clearly it's the case of Assad. If he feels that he has Russia, let alone Iran and Hezbollah, strongly backing him, he has no reason whatsoever to compromise. So there needs to be an understanding between Russia and the U.S. at a minimum. Ideally it would involve others as well, but let's start with what is more manageable, and even that's hard and hasn't been achieved yet, an understanding on what the outcome, the end game would look like. What does it mean for the survival of the Syrian state? What does it mean for the army? What does it mean for the political system and the fate of individuals as well, Bashar among them? If they could reach agreement there, then perhaps they could each exercise pressure on other allies of their respective sides and then on the sides themselves.
During the Cold War, there were a lot of regional wars, especially in Africa, that were proxy wars for Russia and the United States. Is this starting to look that way again, like there's a potential of this becoming a proxy war where the U.S. and Russia are on opposite sides, and that could lead to very bad relations between the U.S. and Russia?
It's a good question, and certainly there are echoes of it. I mean, even if you really want to stretch the analogy the Russians sending advanced anti-air missiles to Syria, is that echo of the Cuban Missile Crisis where the Russians are going to say, we will send these missiles unless you commit not to attack Syria? And President Putin of Russia does seem to have sort of a Cold War streak in him. And my sense is the Russians see Syria not so much, it's not so much for them about Syria. It's about Western intervention in third countries. It's about revenge for the humiliation that Russia has suffered over the years. It's also about the fear of Sunni Islamism. I think Russians truly believe that the U.S. is being naive in allowing or acquiescing or condoning the rise of Sunni Islamists through democratic means in the region. The Russians see them as a mortal threat in their own neighborhood. So I think there's a lot of that, but one of the themes I think that is that runs through Moscow's attitude in this is a very anti-American notion that the U.S. can't be allowed to win this regime change fight in Syria. So yes, you're right. I don't think we're gonna go back to the Cold War. Russia doesn't have the means to conduct that kind of fight. But certainly, it looks more like that than it's looked for some time.
My guest is Robert Malley, director of the International Crisis Group's Middle East and North Africa program. We'll talk more about the widening war in Syria after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Malley. He's the director of the International Crisis Group's Middle East and North Africa program, and we're discussing how the conflict in Syria is becoming a widening war in the Middle East. How do you see what's happening in Syria and the spread regionally of that conflict being connected to the Arab Spring?
First of all, I think we should bury the term Arab Spring once and for all. I mean, it never was the right term. It didn't happen in the spring. It doesn't have any of the springtime elements one in the West would associate it with. And it wasn't exclusively Arab because Kurds were involved. So I think what we're seeing is a confluence of upheavals in the Arab world, one of which is a sentiment of repulsion, disgust, and revolt against authoritarian regimes, which is the one that most people focused on, particularly in the West at the beginning, because it was the most positive one. But all these elements, all these other elements have now glommed onto it, and there is this sectarian struggle, there is this regional struggle, there is this newly minted Cold War, there's this jihadist dimension. So there are positive elements, there are many frightening elements. I just think we have to stay away from a simplified prism of seeing it simply through, merely through the lens of the Arab uprising, which does conjure up more positive images and neglects and ignores all these other dimensions, which were very, very quickly present. My colleague Hussein Aga and I wrote 2 years ago, early on in the uprising, we wrote a piece which we called The Arab Counter-Revolution, pointing to all these other factors. And then 8 months ago, a piece called This Is Not a Revolution, trying to make the point that you can't simply look at this as a revolution. It was sort of a take on the French painter Magritte's painting of a pipe, in which he said, this is not a pipe, but this is a revolution, but it's also not a revolution. There are many other things that are happening, and I think we have to be aware of them, and I think at this point many are, and not simply try to look at it as a democratic uprising by people who are fed up with totalitarian rule. That's one element. Unfortunately, today, it's no longer the dominant one.
So when you look at the Syrian conflict and see how it is widening to different religious groups in other countries, what are some of your worst fears of what might happen?
We touched upon a number of them already. I mean, whether we spoke about Lebanon, the most fragile by far of Syria's neighbors, Iraq, which, again, just still licking its wounds from its own sectarian civil war. Jordan, we didn't mention Jordan, but certainly Jordan, which has always been relatively fragile, is looking with great alarm at what's happening to its north, because instability in Syria could trickle down into Jordan, and it's itself a very fragile concoction that doesn't quite hold together, given the divisions between Islamists, non-Islamists, between Palestinians and Transjordanians. And of course, Turkey, which is going through its own convulsions, but you could weave. Extremely catastrophic scenarios, which are not wholly unrealistic. We spoke about Israel, the Israeli intervention. You could imagine Iran, if it feels like things are really taking a turn for the worse, pouring in troops directly into Syria. You could imagine Iraqi Shiite militias coming in, and then again Sunni militias fighting it out. It's almost impossible to end this worst case scenario exercise. I'm not saying they're the most likely, but certainly the ingredients are there for the kind of regional conflagration that some people have been speaking about for some time. They thought it would be launched more, it would be triggered by an Israeli-Iranian confrontation, and that is one of the layers of what's happening, certainly. But you now have this old Sunni-Shiite sectarian fight, which is metastasizing and which could take on... And what's hard to see is what's the end point, because neither side can accept the victory of the other. So either there's going to be, and this again is where this notion of diplomacy is so key, and it's hard to do in the abstract, and it's hard to do when the balance of power is what it is today, with President Assad feeling quite emboldened. But only a diplomatic settlement in which all sides' core interests are respected is one that could put an end, at least a temporary end, to this conflict, because each side is viewing it as so existential that they cannot accept defeat.
So say the conflict leads to another civil war in Lebanon, an increased sectarian fighting in Iraq and in other countries. In your description, there's still civil wars within countries. But at the same time, you're discussing a war that,
transcends boundaries.
Transcends boundaries, exactly. So do you see, Sunnis in Iraq fighting Shia in Lebanon? I mean, do you see this all it's morphing into one big regional sectarian war?
There are certainly signs of it already. I mean, we've mentioned Hezbollah fighting across the border in Syria. There are Lebanese fighting in Syria on the Sunni side. There are Iraqi Shiites fighting to protect Shiite shrines in Syria, but they may do more than that. And they are jihadists. We didn't mention this phenomenon. I mean, it's probably not the right term, of jihadi tourism, of jihadists who are flocking to Syria because it has become the location, the arena of choice for the Islamist fight, for the jihadist fight. It's already surpassing Iraq in terms of the number of jihadists who are foreign fighters who are coming in. I was just in Europe, and the Europeans are alarmed by how many of their own are now going to fight in Syria and then coming back. And Syria is much, much easier of access than Iraq ever was for jihadists. In Iraq, there was only one country through which they could go, really, which was Syria. Syria's borders are, I mean, on Syria's borders are many countries that are allowing or can't do anything to prevent jihadists from coming in, Turkey, Lebanon, perhaps Iraq. So Syria is not just going to be a place, location for this transnational war between Sunnis and Shiites, but jihadists also are finding it a very attractive place to wage war. And as you say, it could potentially, as already we're seeing signs of it, the borders become simply passageways, gateways, that fighters have to go through in order to wage the fight in any one of the arenas. But there are factors of restraint. Let's not forget them, that each of these actors has limitations. Each of them knows that if it goes too far, it may be courting disaster. So there's some degree of self-restraint, but the factors that are pushing towards greater regional conflict at this point seem the stronger ones.
The pressures toward greater regional
confrontation. I mean, so far, those are the ones that seem to be prevailing, even though, I mean, we could go through each actor one by one and understand and see why they wouldn't have an interest in seeing this happen. But wars often happen against the better judgment of its protagonists.
Robert Malley, thank you so much for talking with
us.
Really appreciate it.
And I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Robert Malley is the director of the International Crisis Group's Middle East and North Africa program. Coming up, our TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new season of Arrested Development. 7 years after being canceled on Fox TV, it's returned with new episodes on Netflix. This is Fresh Air. Our TV critic David Bianculli was on vacation when Netflix unveiled all 15 episodes of its new revival of the cult sitcom Arrested Development. He was able to dive right in anyway, watching all the episodes in a row in one overnight binge fest the morning Netflix made it available. Series creator Mitch Hurwitz advises against watching the new Arrested Development that way, but our critic begs to differ.
When Mitch Hurwitz and his collaborators began making the Fox sitcom Arrested Development 10 years ago, it was so loaded with jokes, in-jokes, recurring jokes, and just plain bizarre jokes, that it rewarded viewers who watched more than once. But even though it won the Emmy for Best Comedy Series 1 year, not enough viewers bothered to watch it even once, so the show was canceled in 2006 after 3 seasons. And that would have been it, except for a loyal cult following that built up once the show was released on DVD and the internet. So finally, on Memorial Day weekend, Arrested Development was reborn, with 15 new episodes released all at once. I binge-viewed them all immediately and loved watching them that way. It's the structure of this new season of Arrested Development that impresses me the most. Like Larry David's Curb Your Enthusiasm, it's got a season-long story arc, as well as tightly sculpted plot twists within each installment. And Arrested Development tries something even more daring, by focusing each episode primarily on a specific character from the large and talented ensemble. This allows the show to revisit the same moments from various points of view in a way that becomes its own running gag. Hidden identities, sudden surprises, perplexing mysteries, they're all unfolded slowly in intertwined fashion, like some sort of comedy double helix. And watching everything in one sitting helps to make those connections even clearer. It also helps to watch in large doses because the season's plot doesn't fully reveal itself until episode 4. That's when Jason Bateman's Michael Bluth, the sane center of a mostly insane family of misfits, is approached to make a movie about his unusual relatives. He sorely needs the money. At the time, he's driving one of those photo-taking Google Maps cars and is excited to pursue the offer. But here's where it all gets complicated and illustrates how Arrested Development is so wonderfully twisted. While Michael is driving in his Google car, the lawyer who phones with the movie offer is played by recurring cast member Henry Winkler. Later in the same scene, Winkler is defended by another lawyer played by Scott Baio, both of whom became famous on the 70s sitcom Happy Days, playing respectively the Fonz and Chachi. And the Hollywood producer-director who is seeking to make a movie about Michael's family? That's Ron Howard, the Happy Days star who not only is one of the executive producers of Arrested Development, but also serves as its narrator.
Hey, Barry, Michael was driving a car from a company that shows every private residence in the country. But it's also a company that won't let us show the car that takes those pictures. In fairness to them, it is their property. If you want to know what the company is...
Save it! We're just going to blur it anyway.
All you have to do is something it.
Barry, you still there?
So I got a really interesting call from...
Ron Howard, of all people. He's directing now, apparently.
And wants to meet you at his office.
In, get this, Beverly Hills.
Why does Ron Howard want to meet with me?
Well, I don't know. His office didn't say, and if you don't mind, I'm a little busy with a case of my own.
Did you get any other information?
Apparently, he directed a movie called Cocoon.
Sorry, I was unclear. About why he wants to meet with me.
I don't know. You want me to tell him to go
himself? I can tell Ron Howard to go himself. I can tell him to shove it up his I just can't do it now.
Because I'm in front of a jury.
Barry, I will meet with him. Well, you're in front of a jury right now?
Oh, and the looks I'm getting. Gotta go.
Sorry, since everybody. Each cast I'm member gets to take center stage for at least one episode, it seems almost unfair to single out any of them. Except for Bateman, whose dry delivery is the gravity that keeps this whole enterprise from spinning off into space. But it would seem just as unfair not to heap extra praise upon Jessica Walter and Portia de Rossi, as Michael Bluth's mother and sister, respectively, for their fully committed, truly funny work here. So much about these new Arrested Development shows had me laughing out loud, and often. Sometimes it was the revival of a running gag I'd forgotten about, like the use of the music from A Charlie Brown Christmas to indicate sadness, or the simple use of the phrase, get this. And get this, these 15 shows are loaded with guest stars, from Kristen Wiig and John Slattery to recurring players Liza Minnelli and James Lipton. And Ron Howard even shows up on screen playing himself. And I guess I shouldn't be surprised, but after all these years since being on camera on The Andy Griffith Show and Happy Days, Ron Howard still knows how to deliver a punchline. Here he is, portraying himself, explaining his movie idea to Michael Bluth, played by Jason Bateman. And at the same time, Howard does double duty during the scene in his regular role as narrator.
Plus, I've been dying to figure out a way to do something about the market crash. Ever since my partner Brian Grazer was tipped off that it was 3 months away from happening.
What's that?
But I never had a face to put on it. Until now, you, your wife is dying. You're trying to hold your family together.
Oh, gosh, no. My wife died years before any of this.
Oh, gee. I think it's a lot more fun if we see her die.
That is fun.
And by the way, then it's a fantastic part for a leading lady. In fact, a girl rebel would be great in that part.
Your girl?
Rebel Alley? She's an actress, you know her. He didn't.
I do. Yes, of course I do. You're a girl, huh?
Well, we kind of like to keep that quiet.
Michael assumed that by my girl, Ron was referring to his mistress.
See, I see why you're telling me in the lamb, huh?
But Ron was actually talking about his daughter.
You probably think I'm terrible for even mentioning her to you.
Oh, no, no, I'm not one to judge. I'm sure you've all got girls up here in Hollywood, huh?
Brian's got two boys.
It'll be very interesting to see, at the end of the TV year, if Netflix's Arrested Development earns its way into one of the nominated spots for a Best Comedy Emmy. It's eligible, and it's been there before. And even though it's no longer on TV as we used to define it, it deserves to be nominated again.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. Tomorrow on our show, we'll feature the interview I just recorded with the creator of Arrested Development, Mitch Hurwitz. You probably won't be surprised to hear he's really funny. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Concord Records, presenting Inspiration, the new album by guitarist and singer George Benson, a tribute to Nat King Cole at Best Buy. From Angie's List, providing reviews of local roofers, painters, landscapers, and plumbers to keep the consumer informed. More at angieslist.com. And from Subaru, introducing the all-new 2014 Forester. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Learn more at Subaru.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the creator of the TV series Arrested Development, Mitch Hurwitz. 6 years after this cult hit was canceled by the Fox network, Hurwitz has brought us a new season of 15 episodes on Netflix. People have been binge-watching it all over.
And purge-watching it.
And purge-watching it. Join us.